Hey, everybody. If you are a writer or an aspiring writer, or if you just love literature, I have a book for you. It's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. It is the long-awaited craft book by Steve Almond, based on 3 decades of his writing career, a career that has featured at turns depression, failure, anxiety, self-loathing, despair, self-doubt, loss of faith, delusions of grandeur, and the occasional triumph. It's a book about the writing life. Steve Almond has done it. He has embraced it, the full catastrophe, and he has lived to tell about it. The Boston Globe says, quote, "This isn't just a book about writing. It's a book about honesty." And Richard Russo calls it, quote, "one of the best books on writing I've ever read. It's also the funniest by a country mile." Once again, it's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories by Steve Almond, available from Zando. Go get your copy right now, wherever you buy books.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey there, welcome to the program. This is the Other People Show. I'm Brad Listy here in Los Angeles, California. It's nice to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you're doing all right wherever you happen to be. Don't forget to subscribe to this show wherever you listen. You can also subscribe on YouTube. Follow the Other People podcast on social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. So today my guest is Mona Awad. She has a new novel out called Rouge.
So I think that's really what it is. I just think the fantastic and our fantasies, because fairy tales, I mean, in a lot of ways, they're just wish fulfillments, right? They're wish fulfillments. And I think our wishes and desires lay us bare more than we like to think. Like, they reveal the reality of our hearts, our anxieties and our desires in such poignant ways. Our fantasies do. And so I really like playing with that line in my books.
Okay, that was Mona Awad. Her new novel is called Rouge. It is available from Simon & Schuster. Rouge is an eerie, hypnotic, richly imagined, gothic fairy tale. I think that's a fair way to describe it. It's about a young woman who is mourning the loss of her estranged mother. So it's a novel about grief. It is a mother-daughter story. It is a story about the dark side of a culture, our culture, that is obsessed with youth and beauty. Rouge is also a novel that finds its inspiration in interesting and often disparate places, in stories like Snow White and movies like Eyes Wide Shut. This is a book that is laced with black humor. It is a book about surfaces and what lies beneath. My conversation with Mona Awad is coming up in just a couple of minutes. A quick reminder before we get going that I do a weekly email newsletter. I would love it if you would subscribe. You can do so at otherppl.com or bradlisty.com. The newsletter is simple. I let you know about the latest episodes of the show. I also share some links to things that I've been reading and finding interesting. So if you want to get my newsletter, go sign up at otherppl.com or bradlisty.com. If you love this program, if you listen regularly, if you get something from it, or if you're just a person who loves literary culture, join the Other People Patreon community and help keep this show going into the future. You can also get merchandise and a book club subscription, all sorts of fun stuff over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Okay, so my guest, once again, is Mona Awad. She is the author of several books, including the novels All's Well and Bunny, as well as a short story collection called 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl. Bunny was a finalist for a Goodreads Choice Award and the New England Book Award. It was named a best book of 2019 by Time Magazine, Vogue, and the New York Public Library. It is currently being adapted for film by Jenny Connor and New Regency Productions. So that's exciting. Mona Awad is a teacher of fiction in the creative writing program at Syracuse University, and I'm very excited to have her here on the Other People podcast. So let's get to it. This is my conversation with Mona Awad, and her new novel, one more time, is called Rouge.
And I was working on Rouge and, you know, getting inspired. You know, it got really Byzantine and crazy. I mean, I tried everything. You know, I tried mists, I tried different acids, I tried masks, I tried beauty bombs, I tried snail mucin, which is a thing. You know, you put snail mucin on your face and it does all kinds of glowy, wonderful things.
Wait, what is snail mucin? It's like the little slime from snails?
It's extract from snails. It doesn't hurt the snail. It's just collected and put on the face. And there is, like, there's a fairy tale quality to that, right? I like the more magic-y kind of ingredients as opposed to the more science-driven ingredients. Those seem kind of boring to me. But usually a skincare product sort of likes to present itself as an unholy mix of both. Like, there's some science stuff here, some retinol for you, some vitamin C, you know, some niacinamide. And then here also is some, like, some green tea and some willow bark and some snail.
Aloe, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like it's a botanical extracts, you know, which can be good or bad for you. But I kind of went full circle. And by the end of the writing process, I was back down to like two or three products, a cleanser, a moisturizer, and a sunscreen. You know.
Okay. I'm sort of there. Like, my dermatologist, who I have to see like twice a year because I have like pre-skin cancer. I mean, I'm a mess.
Right.
And he's like, you got to wear sunscreen. And
yeah.
So I do religiously. But like, I put this sunscreen on my face and then I'll go exercise and I will like sweat. And like, if it gets in my eyes, it's like I've been pepper sprayed.
Right.
And I'm like, this shit cannot be good for me. If it's doing this to my eyes, like, what is it doing to my skin? I get that it's like blocking UV rays.
Right.
It seems like a necessary evil, but I'm mistrustful of anything that burns my eyes that badly. Or you said you were using acids. I'm like,
yeah,
I'm a little bit suspect of anything that's going to cause like a burning.
Yeah. I mean, I know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of, you know, speculation about to what degree these things actually work and how much do we really need them and how much do they help versus harm us. I mean, but I did enjoy those acids. They were fun, I have to say.
Did they yield good results? Like, did you see?
Yeah, I think they do impart a glow, you know, cause they exfoliate your dead skin. They get rid of the dead skin. So I mean, but then if you do it too much, you can get in a really terrible loop and your skin can get really irritated and then that's it. You've kind of undone whatever good you were doing. So you have to be really careful with it. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like, it is a dangerous rabbit hole, but it was fun. I do have to say, experimenting, it was like being a child again and like playing with potions, you know, what can this do? What can this do? How can this, you know, change me? And you know, and the change is so minor, like it's just like, is there going to be a little glow or not? I don't know.
And it's also about the psychological impact. This is the hook of these products, is that like it does give some little hit of like dopamine or psychological relief, or you feel
yeah.
a little bit better. That's enough yeah. to keep you going, I feel like, oftentimes.
I think so too. And I think that, you know, when I started writing the book, you know, it was during the pandemic, the start of it actually. And I think I was partly so into the videos because it was a really weird time. And I think, you know, we were all seeking a kind of consolation where we could find it, you know? And so, yeah, I think, and I was more isolated. We all were. and maybe as a result, more vulnerable. And so things like skincare and rituals feels like you're taking back some kind of little bit of control, or, you know, you're doing something good for yourself.
Right.
So, I mean, it's, you know, I really do think there are restorative and healing things about it, like lovely things. But I also think there's this other element to it that maybe is a little bit more nefarious. And, you know, the book is really all about how sometimes when we are fixated on the surface too much, it's at the expense of the depths, you know, and that's a problem, right?
Hmm. So. Well, let's talk about this book and the setup.
Yeah.
So that listeners who have not yet had a chance to read can be in the loop. Your protagonist is a young woman named Mirabel Knorr,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And she is in La Jolla, California, which is a Tony suburb north of San Diego, right?
Yes.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. It's where I wrote it.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. But this is where she has come because her mother has died under mysterious circumstances.
Right.
And the gist is that she gets involved in kind of beauty cult.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother, and there's a mystery around like the association that her mother may have had with it and what it all entailed,
right,
and what it meant to her,
right,
demise.
Right.
So I won't spoil anything, but that's kind of the setup. And
right,
one of the things I want to talk to you right away, because I think that this applies not only to Rouge, but to your entire body of work. This book really made me feel it. And I kept thinking to myself, like, wow, like Mona has like real creative confidence. Because like a willingness to pursue your whims as a writer on the page and to kind of follow your imagination wherever it takes you. Freedom is maybe another mm-hmm. word I would use, a creative freedom.
Right.
Because as I was reading, I was like, no, she can't be going there. And then it's like, oh my God, she's really like not only going there, she's like doubling and tripling down on certain storylines or certain fairy tale like qualities. And so I admire that. I think I might have more reticence creatively than I wish that I did. And so whenever somebody feels unbound, it's like, oh, that's really cool. And it makes the work feel alive and interesting in ways that are not maybe bound to reality necessarily, or not as constricted or something. So where does that come from? I mean, do you agree with me that you try to kind of employ that in your work? And if so, where do you feel like that comes from?
Yeah, I think I do. And I think it comes from maybe my experience writing Bunny, because that was really in the dark and like a huge leap from my first book, which was a much more realist telling of a woman's experience.
And that was 13 ways to look at a fat girl.
That's right. Yeah. And so with Bunny, because I was moving into new spheres, you know, following this person's consciousness, who's a creative writer, into the unreal, because that's how she's really experiencing the world. You know, her imagination is a huge part of her perspective, you know, on reality. So I had to kind of take a bit of a leap, and it was really scary, but it felt really good. And at first, the responses that I got were kind of not great. Like they were a little like, what are you doing? You know? And I was like, oh shit, like nobody's going to want to publish this book.
Like, responses from whom? Just from friends who were reading?
No, industry responses. And so I was just like, well, you know, maybe 13 Ways is going to be my last book, and this one's just going to be in a drawer. And at first that made me really sad. Like I felt really stupid and sad and like, what are you doing? Like, you're just writing this crazy book about boys who are, you know, conjured from bunnies and like, you know, what is this? And like, but then I just really missed it. And I wanted to find out what happened, you know, 'cause I wasn't finished.
Okay, let me stop you real quick. So just so that we're clear on what was happening, like you had written partial.
Yeah, I'd written.
You had a partial manuscript that you then what, shared with it your editor who edited 13 ways?
No, I didn't share it with her. I shared it with my first agent. Yeah. And I just, you know, didn't get the best. I mean, she's lovely and everything is fine and it's totally amicable and, you know, there's no issue at all. She was a great agent. But I really did feel from her response that, this is just not going to be a thing. And then I just wanted to continue writing it myself. And I actually wrote it thinking it would never see the light of day. And I was just going to take delight in it on my own. And so, which was very freeing and really wonderful and created such an intense bond with the story that I realized what I loved the most about being creative is that private interchange between yourself and the story. That experience is, for me, is why I do it. And then when I shared it with friends, I mean, I got really great responses, and then I thought, well, I am gonna try to like put this out there. But it was really like a moment in the dark of deep fear and thinking, this is it. But even if this is it, I'm still gonna write it. And so now I write from that place always, because I found in it real agency and freedom, and a kind of intimacy with the story that I'd never experienced before.
So when it comes to actual practice,
yeah,
I know from reading up a little bit that you tend to write best early in the morning, first thing.
Yes.
You get to your keyboard. The only way to really get a book done is to do it pretty consistently.
Yes.
So every day or close to it, you're getting some words on the page.
Yes.
All of that stuff makes sense to me. But when it comes to actual practice, like I guess it's just an internal feeling of freedom, like it's an attitude. Are there tangible things you can detect in the way that you approach the work post-Bunny that were not in effect when you were writing your debut?
Yes. I am far less likely to fret over sentences the way that I fretted over sentences in 13 ways. I am far more likely to give myself permission to be imperfect as long as I feel like the voice is alive. If the voice is alive, that's what I trust and follow and commit to completely. And if the sentences aren't perfect, that's okay. As long as I feel like I've got the voice right and I believe in the voice. So that's what I pay attention to. And I try to leave my anxiety about it being perfect aside. And I'm more and more comfortable doing that the more I work, even though it's very hard. Like the anxiety is very real and I face it every day. And it's telling me like, you know, this isn't good, you know, whatever. Like I still just keep.
Go put some acid on your face. Go give yourself a peel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like you have to put that desire to be perfect. I have to put it aside, and I am getting better and better at doing that. Yeah.
We should say that Bunny was your breakout book.
Yes. Yes.
It connected really deeply with a lot of readers. It found a lot of readers. It was a bestseller. It was optioned by Bad Robot, the J.J. Abrams company. What is the status of that, by the way? I feel like these things are always in development forever. Did it happen?
I miss it? No, it didn't get made, but it just got optioned. We're just kind of at the opening stages of development. And then, of course, the strike happens. So we'll just wait and see what happens on the other side. But it's a really exciting partnership. I mean, I really, really love the producers who are working on it.
That's awesome. And it's a lesson. It's a lesson for writers out there who might be working on something and experiencing resistance either in the marketplace or from a mentor or colleague or someone in the industry, that if you really deeply believe in something, and I think what you said earlier is maybe the crucial point, if you would finish it anyway, just for your own delight and interest, that's a really good sign, because finishing it anyway is no small task. Writing a novel is a big lift. That's a lot of labor.
Yeah, it is.
So if you are willing to undertake that labor just because it means that much to you and is that interesting to you? I feel like there's a lesson in that. That's what you did with Bunny, and that's what you're trying to replicate going forward.
Yeah. Finding that space. Because I know now that if I trust myself, trust the story rather. I mean, I know I'm writing the story, but you know what I mean. When you're writing, it really does feel like the story also has its own machinery, its own agenda, its own life, right? So following it and trusting it, even if it fails, I mean, that is the joy of it. That's the whole point in doing it, is that experience of following is so wonderful.
Well, and you said that you don't tend to be as precious about sentences as you are drafting.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, on the back end, does this mean like you're having a different experience revising than you previously did? Is it one of these things where you're kind of giving yourself more permission to write a messier first draft just to get the story on the page and to indulge the whims of your imagination and to trust in that creative process, and then you're fixing it up later more than you were, say, with your debut? Maybe your debut was more arduous and constricted, but yet required less on the back end.
Oh God, no. My debut was just, I mean, I rewrote some of those stories about a million times. I mean, oh my gosh. so funny. I mean, it's just thinking about how many iterations like that book went through to its published form. It's crazy. I mean, it started off as a poem, you know, and then 13 years later, it's a novel. More than 13 years later. But with the novels now, what I tend to do is I will kind of commit myself to writing that first draft with a kind of freedom and permission. Again, the only caveat to that is I have to believe in that voice. So if I'm stuck and I'm not quite believing the voice and the voice feels a little wooden and not alive, then I'll step away for a bit until I feel like I find my way in. And then when I go back and I do revise, I add layers, I fine tune the voice, I deal with any kind of plot issues that are still kind of lingering. And that takes time. Like that will take, like Rouge, for example, I wrote most of it in 5 weeks, the first draft of it. And then,
I should say that's really fast.
I know. But as a teacher, who teaches during, you know, during the fall and spring semester, you in order to get work done, sometimes you just really have to, you know, give yourself over during your breaks, right? So I did that. And then I spent quite a long time, you know, sitting with each chapter and adding the layers and, you know, making sure that the plot worked and making sure that the voices felt right to me, that the dialogue rang true, and that the surreal elements were grounded enough in reality, like all of those things. Because for me, the surreal still has to have like a real, something real needs to be at stake even in the surreal moments in the book. So making sure that all of that is working takes time. So it actually, Rouge did take 2 years to write, ultimately. Yeah.
But it's easier, maybe. That's always easier to work with something that's on the page, right? It's getting that draft down. That's a workable draft.
Yes.
It's the hardest part. Once you have that, then you at least got something to mold.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I do love that time with it. I love kind of sitting with something that I have and just kind of working with it, even if it frustrates me and sometimes I don't know what I'm doing. It's really lovely to have the draft. You know.
Yeah, the worst is when you've got nothing.
The worst is when you have nothing. Definitely, definitely. The worst is when you have nothing.
Hey, everybody. If you are a writer or an aspiring writer, or if you just love literature, I have a book for you. It's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. It is the long-awaited craft book by Steve Almond, based on 3 decades of his writing career, a career that has featured at turns depression, failure, anxiety, self-loathing, despair, self-doubt, loss of faith, delusions of grandeur, and the occasional triumph. It's a book about the writing life. Steve Almond has done it. He has embraced it, the full catastrophe, and he has lived to tell about it. The Boston Globe says, quote, "This isn't just a book about writing. It's a book about honesty.
And Richard Russo calls it, quote, one of the best books on writing I've ever read. It's also the funniest by a country mile. Once again, it's called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories by Steve Almond, available from Zando. Go get your copy right now, wherever you buy books.
So something that you said earlier, I think you just said it. We didn't really get into it, but I want to talk about it because I learned this about you after I finished reading Rouge, and it illuminated the work. I guess I should have deduced it, but it's this term fairy tale.
Yeah.
There is a fairy tale like quality to this book. Mm-hmm. And you said the word surreal. There's surreality, but it's rooted in reality.
Yes.
And then as I dug around deeper in prep, I learned that you actually, I believe in graduate school, did you get your PhD studying fairy tales or something like that? It was like fear in fairy tales. You grew up reading the Brothers Grimm.
Yes.
Like, I love learning this stuff about a writer because it's like, oh, it all kind of clicked into place. I'm like, these are her deep concerns.
Yeah.
And that's why this book is so infused with that feeling. So can you just talk a little bit about that education and that love of fairy tales and how you have found ways to use it in your work?
Yeah, of course. I did love them as a child. And I loved fairy tale adjacent novels too, like The Chronicles of Narnia and Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. And they all felt like, even though they were inhabiting these other worlds, still felt like there was something very real at stake for the characters in those worlds, you know? I mean, Wizard of Oz, unbelievably so, right? I mean, she just wants to find her way home. And I just think it's such a gorgeous story, and definitely did inform Rouge a little bit with the red shoes. And then, you know, I started studying fairy tales later. I returned to them as an adult. I studied them at the University of Edinburgh for a year, and I wrote a dissertation on fear in the fairy tale. And it was really fun to write that and to read them as more critically. But I really, it just got me excited to work with them creatively, because I really think fairy tales, even though they have these magical elements, they are dealing with real life concerns and crises, especially for young people, like for children, and also parental anxieties, you know, anxieties between siblings, a lot of things that you experience that on such a like elemental level, they're so fundamental to just being alive and being human. Fairy tales deal with in a fantastic way, you know? And so Snow White was really the fairy tale that I explored in Rouge. And I was always interested in it because I've always found that relationship between the queen and the mirror so fascinating and so mysterious. Her vulnerability and just wondering whether or not the mirror is really an entity that is feeding this dark impulse inside of her, or if she's just engaging with her own reflection, you know, you don't really know. And I wanted to explore that in this book. I wanted to make the mirror more of a more instrumental in pitting the mother against the daughter than we usually find in the fairy tale, because I just love that mirror so much. Such a mysterious figure.
Mirrors are strange.
They are strange. Yeah. They are strange.
And I was thinking about this just the other day. I was like, how do you make a mirror?
Yeah.
Like, how did anyone discover how to make a mirror?
Yeah.
Like, what is it? It's sand? Like, what is it? It's so strange.
Yeah. I mean, it's that was, you know, the ocean that plays such a huge role in the book is kind of the first mirror, right? The water reflecting the light. And it's so like pretty on the surface, but then there are these unimaginable depths beneath it. I think the mirror is equally mysterious, you know? And the fact that when we see ourselves only in reverse, it's such a strange, the mirrors are so strange.
It's the only time we ever see our own eyes.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So I think that's really what it is. I just think the fantastic and our fantasies, because fairy tales, I mean, in a lot of ways, they're just wish fulfillments, right? They're wish fulfillments. And I think our wishes and desires lay us bare more than we like to think. Like, they reveal the reality of our hearts. our anxieties and our desires in such poignant ways. Our fantasies do. And so I really like playing with that line in my books.
I feel like you've said that your books tend to have a careful what you wish for vibe.
Yes. Yeah, they do. They do. Yeah. And I think that's very true of fairy tales. And there are lots of insidious reasons why fairy tales kind of have that message, careful what you wish for. Because ultimately, it's about staying in your place, right? And only some of us are anointed and chosen to move elsewhere, to move on, to transform, to have wealth and have the person of your dreams, and all of that stuff, to become free and powerful. But always careful what you wish for is still, like, it's a good thing to remember that what you long for might not necessarily be what you need or what you really, really want. And, you won't know that because it just exists as a dream, right?
It occurs to me that we rarely question our deep longings in that way. The things we really obsessively wish for and think we need.
Yes.
There's a feeling of certainty that goes along with that most of the time, it seems like. If it's this deeply rooted within me, if I'm this fixated on it, and I can envision it so clearly and, all the ways that it's going to fix me or make my life better or whatever it is, that's very seductive. It's easy to trust that. And yet, we can be wrong.
We can be wrong. And having the thing, I don't know, that's its own curious, like, place to occupy, right? I mean, we're in positions of longing for so long. What is it like to actually have the longing fulfilled? Is it really what you think it will be? The fairy tales definitely explore that and show the shadow side of that that you may not have anticipated.
I feel like sometimes the most unhappy people in the world are the people who get this surface level stuff thinking it's going to make them happy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. And when they have it and that longing is fulfilled and then they're still miserable, that's the real misery.
Yes. And going back to YouTube, I think that there's something there in that, in the pursuit of great skin, the pursuit of beauty, the pursuit of whatever it is. Surface level things. Yeah, because there's something else underneath that pursuit. Ultimately, I think, the book is really kind of exploring this, it's about anxiety of about death. It's about the fear of losing yourself. Really, when we're looking in the mirror and we feel anxious, that's what we're feeling. We may use skincare to attend to it, but what it is just the knowledge that we are all mortal and it's going. We're in it, and we inevitably are going to lose ourselves, and that's quite deep. But the pursuit of skincare seems to be quite a surface thing. But I think that one informs the other, no question, no question.
Yeah, that's so true. I think anything related to health, wellness, like this entire space, the health and wellness space, beauty space, it is all about helping you to fend off mortality or to create the illusion that you can.
Yes.
And to distract you from it or whatever it is. But deep down inside of it is just fear of death.
Yes, I do think that's what it is. And I couldn't stop when I was watching those videos. There was a point at which I couldn't stop thinking about that. This is what this is all really about. This is the thing that is unspoken that we're really trying to put a little bomb on. Literally a bomb. On this fear of the abyss, this fear that we are going to lose ourselves. Here's a bomb for that. Here's a glow.
Here's some snail mucin.
Yes, exactly.
By the way, I'm going to Google after we get off this call. I want to see how the mucin is extracted from the snails.
Yes.
I'm picturing like a person like milking a snail or something. But
I think there's a net involved. I do think there's a net, and I know that. Who knows what's true. But according to the YouTubers, the snails are not harmed. So
okay. I'm a little bit doubtful, but we'll find out. So fairy tales we've covered as like a founding principle of this work and your work generally. It's interesting to me. I think about that debut of yours, which you said was really arduous to write and was more bound to reality. You know, it was a little bit more constricted in its creative process. And yet, you know, you were self-aware enough to go get an advanced degree studying fairy tales. You knew this was something that you really loved as a reader, as a child, as an intellectual. Like, there was something in there that you really wanted to mine.
Yeah.
And it was when you finally honored that in your work that it really kind of took off.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you kind of skipped in that first book. You skipped over it. Maybe you didn't quite have the confidence or the trust in yourself or something, or the trust in your own instincts at that point to use it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I hadn't, you know, I started off as a poet. And so learning to even write a story, you know, there were some challenges that I had to move through. I read a lot of short fiction. I read a lot of novels. You know, eventually I did go for an MFA, and that's where I finished that first book. And it helped a lot with finishing it. But I was really learning how to be a fiction writer when I was writing 13 Ways. I was learning how to move away from poetry into prose. And I knew I wanted to work with prose. So the idea of not only moving from poetry to prose, but moving to, you know, surreal prose. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I think that would have been maybe too much. And I always thought, you really love fairy tales. Like, one of these days, your love for, like, because in 13 Ways, what's explored and what I also love, maybe just as much, is really intimate monologues, like really intimate first-person voices. I love writers who do that kind of very close first-person. You know, I love Kazuo Ishiguro. I love Jean Rhys. I love David Mitchell's, like, first-person present tense narratives. I just love those narratives that feel really visceral and real and, you know, and very forthcoming and vulnerable. And so 13 Ways is that. But I didn't really know how to wed the fairy tale with that until Bunny. I feel like that's what I kind of tried to do in that book. And I love the mix of the two because, like I said, I really do think it was the realization that fairy tales are more grounded in the real than we think.
Okay. So,
do it, yeah.
Fairy tales, surreality, and then the next, like, buzzword that I feel like is important to address is Gothic.
Yes, yes.
And I was reading about your upbringing. You're from Canada. You were born in Montreal, correct?
Right.
An Egyptian father, French-Canadian mother.
Yes.
And educated in an Anglophone school despite being in a family that was predominantly French-speaking.
Yes.
So I presume you speak French. French is infused throughout Rouge. I mean, the title is French,
yes.
So
yeah.
It's in there.
Mm-hmm. It's in there.
And I read that you dropped out of high school three times.
Yes, I did.
College once,
first year.
And you were a goth teenager. You moved to Toronto, I think, in high school or something, right?
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. It was the transition into grade 8, so it was, like, close to high school. Yeah. Middle school.
So what was going on to drop out? You seem like a pretty straight, I mean, you seem pretty, I don't know. I don't talk to you and think, well, this is somebody who dropped out of school four times. Like, you were struggling at that age.
I was, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's always been really easy for me to feel stupid. And it's always been really hard for me to be in, like, a large group setting. Like, I've always found that difficult. So school, the whole system of school, it's just, it was hard for me, you know, it was really, really hard for me. And
now you're a teacher.
And now I'm a teacher. And I actually think to some degree, it helps me as a teacher, to have had those experiences. Cause I'm really mindful of that when I talk to my students, when I engage my students, when I try to include, you know, all of my students and think about them all as individuals, as opposed to just one big group, it just makes me more mindful. You know, and I am grateful. I mean, the reason I was able to finish high school is because at the time in the 90s in Ontario, Canada, where I was, there was an alternative school that was free and there were small classes. And I was able to transfer there and finish. So I was really, really grateful. I don't even know if that program still exists, but it helped me, and I know it helped a lot of other kids who had similar issues with just being in a school setting, in a traditional school setting.
Yeah. And it was emotional and psychological more than it was like an attention issue. Like, it was truly like feeling, you said you have an easy time feeling stupid.
Yeah.
I kind of relate to that. That's why,
yeah,
I think I do this show.
Yeah.
I'm like, I tell myself in my like darker self-talk.
Yeah.
I'm like, look, I'm a mediocrity intellectually. I don't know what's going on, and I don't have any special gift.
Yeah.
I need to talk to smart people, like,
yeah,
help to shore up my deficiencies or whatever, you know. And I think that there is some of that. And I also think like life humbles you, right?
Yes.
Maybe as you get older, life humbles you, and then you,
yes,
go, wow, I thought I had a handle on this.
Yeah.
Like, I really don't. Like,
yeah,
if I was that wrong about this, then I've lost all trust and confidence in my assessment of everything else.
Yes, yes.
I think
that's so true. And yeah, that was definitely true for me too as a kid. I was pretty insecure and not confident at all. And, you know, I did struggle with depression as a kid. So I feel like that was probably part of it. And you know, the goth subculture did really help me, because in a lot of ways, yes, on the surface, goth is really very dark and we embrace melancholy, but it has such a wryness and such a self-mocking quality to it that it was a joy. You know, it was like there's a smile underneath all of this, and that's comforting, you know. So it helped me a lot, and I did get through it, you know. I'm grateful.
So let's talk just a bit about the aesthetics of,
yeah,
goth teenager Mona Awad, like, you know, depressed, jumping around from school to school, not sure, yeah, if she even wants to continue school, but then you find this goth aesthetic and this goth community, and it resonates with you.
Yeah.
So like all black, mm-hmm, listening to The Cure and Joy Division, and what else, right? Yeah. I mean, the whole thing.
Oh, the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, oh my gosh. I mean, we were so many bands that used to come through Toronto. Toronto used to be like a real, they had a real scene, you know, it was great. And used to go to clubs and everything. It was so much fun. But yeah, I mean, it was joyous, even though it was melancholy. The embrace of melancholy was joyous.
That was it. Learning to,
yeah,
kind of give it a hug instead,
yeah,
of resist it.
Exactly. Learning. Exactly. I think that's what it was. Learning to find it beautiful rather than just pushing it away and saying that's bad, you know, was joyous. And of course the music just felt like home, you know.
Well, so that's what I was going to say. I was just, yeah, going to say, like, wow, it's like if you're a depressed teenager, one good thing to do is to realize that there can be an excellent soundtrack for,
yes,
your shitty feelings. It is out there.
It is
waiting for you.
Definitely out there. Yes.
And in addition, there's also like costuming. There's an entire aesthetic waiting for you. You know, that's the appeal of the goth subculture,
yes,
I feel like. And
yes,
it's nice that you point out that it is this wry kind of winking,
yes,
melancholy. It's like self-aware.
Yes. Yes.
Goth.
Yes.
You know,
and
aesthetics.
I always feel at home when I'm among the self-aware. You know, like, or at least people who try to be self-aware. Just the effort to be self-aware is such a great thing. And I love that about the goth community. It is aware of itself in a fun way. So.
What were you reading as a teenager? Were there early books that you like latched onto as a depressed teen that made a big difference for you or that set you on this course?
You know, it's so funny. I mean, I took this literature class in high school that got me really excited about all of these 20th century existential writers that, you know, I never knew before. So, you know, I did read, I read Beckett. I loved Beckett when I was a teenager, the plays. I read Sartre. It's so funny, but I did. I loved Sartre. And I read Hesse, of course. Thought Hesse was like the best thing on the planet. Damien was the best novel ever written, you know. When I was 17, it was like my touchstone. And then, of course, Marguerite Duras. I loved her so much. I loved The Lover. I still remember where I was when I read that book.
Where were you?
I was in High Park in Toronto. not in school. So, yeah.
Taking a break.
taking a break.
To self-educate.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and books at the time, they were like friends, you know? It's just like this wonderful interaction with like just words on a page, but it was this incredible world that you get to occupy, right? That's just for you. So yeah, I think that's where I kind of really fell in love with reading, and then really wanted to try writing.
Anyone in your family writerly?
No, not at all. I mean, yeah, my mother was like a serious reader. Like she would read almost a book a night, and she worked long hours, but she still read every single night. And I will never forget her throwing a copy of Jean Le Carré's, it was the Russia House, across the room, and it hit the wall. She was mad at it. The ending upset her.
This is the spy novel.
Yeah. But I remember being really like moved by that and thinking, wow, a book could have that, you know, could give somebody that kind of reaction. That's amazing.
Any structural damage to the house? Like, how fast did she throw it?
She really threw it. It was crazy.
That's a discerning reader. Every writer should be so lucky to have a writer or a reader who gets that upset.
I know. That's what I thought too. I was like, wow, that's an experience. That's so cool. I want to do that one day. I want a book to make me do that. Yeah.
I was just thinking, has anyone ever thrown my book across the room? I don't know. You know,
you'd have hopefully. To take it as a compliment for sure.
Of course. So I'm going to jump around a little bit biographically. And there's actually a method to my madness because I think that these two things are related. But for somebody who grew up in Montreal and then Toronto, goth teenager, skipping school, dropping out, listening to Joy Division,
yes.
I'm imagining lots of eyeliner.
Yes.
You then get, I'm trying to like trace the biographical line, but you end up after, I guess, college.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to undergrad?
Oh, in Toronto, I went to York.
Okay.
Well, York first, and then I ended up at Glendon, which is the same university, but their French campus.
Okay. So after that, I'm probably skipping a ton of stuff, but you end up getting married and then moving to Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Of all places. Like, it just seems like, I feel like, I mean, Salt Lake City's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's a gorgeous place. I'm sure it's lovely to live there.
Yeah.
But it must have been strange for you. That's the feeling that I had. Like for this Canadian woman with like goth tendencies to suddenly be in like Mormon Mecca must have been strange, right?
Yeah, it was. It was. But it was good. You know, it was like it was new. It was a new experience. And I loved that. I loved paying attention to that, you know, and having the opportunity to pay attention to a new place, you know, new people, a new landscape. I thought Utah was stunning. I mean, I think it's a gorgeous state.
It really is.
It's like beyond gorgeous, right? And Salt Lake is so incredible. I mean, you're surrounded by mountains. Everywhere you look, there's the mountains, you know, all these amazing canyons and it was gorgeous, but yeah, of course it was so surreal and strange, but I did find communities there.
Well,
there's a little,
you joined a belly dancing troupe, which I have to ask you about.
Yeah. I did. It was great. You know, it was a way to kind of, well, I think to find, community, of course, which I did. And it was also just interesting to me, you know, that there really is a culture, a belly dancing culture in Salt Lake City. Like there are a lot of troupes, and there are a lot of performances.
This is surprising to me to learn.
And
this.
It was surprising to me. And I thought it was, I thought it was so interesting that as a writer, you know, my curiosity is what led me to just, you know, try it and get involved and kind of watch and have the experience.
Well, but is this also a way to explore maybe your Egyptian heritage? Like, was that a part of it?
I think it was a little bit. Like, for sure it was. But it was kind of a weird way of doing it, you know, because there aren't a lot of, you know, Egyptians in Salt Lake. There are some, actually. You know, of course there are. But the belly dance community, you know, is I mean, it's mostly Utahns, so, you know, a lot of people who are just, some of them are even Mormon, you know.
I was going to say, like, yeah. Why do I always picture Utah people, Mormons, as being blonde? But there's a lot of blonde
people. There are a lot of blonde people. So
I'm picturing, like, were there, like, blonde Mormon belly dancers?
Yeah, there are. There are. Yes. Yeah. Wow. No, it's really interesting. I mean, I found it a fascinating counterculture. I don't even know if it's counter. It was just a culture, like a really interesting art culture, like community in Salt Lake City that I didn't expect to find and that I found.
Was there any menace? I mean, I feel like you're always going to locate the darkness. I feel like you have an antenna for this thing, but like in Salt Lake City, and I should say too, in all, I don't mean to paint with too broad of a brush, but I just have to say that in all of my, and I've heard other people say this too, so there is some corroboration. In all of my interactions with Mormon people through the years, very nice people.
Yes.
Like sweet.
Yes.
I know, I mean, I'm sure there are some asshole Mormons out there, but like, you know, I don't know. Just like the rank and file Mormon people that I've interacted with, I'm like, wow, they're unusually just kind and cheerful, you know, these people. They're memorable in that way.
Yes.
But of course, you know, if you read like Under the Banner of Heaven, you're like, not everyone
qualifies,
you know.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to know, like, during your experiences living in Salt Lake City, if you located the Gothic side of the town.
Oh, I definitely did. I mean, I was part of that community too, and I loved it, and it was a great community actually. And the belly dance community and the goth community overlap just a little bit, not entirely obviously, but a little. So it was a very kind of easy discovery to make. And that's
so wait, just so I'm clear, there was a goth community in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And how do you find these people? Is there just a club you go to or something? Or
yeah, and also shows, right? You go to shows. You know, bands move through Salt Lake City, and so when you go to the shows and they're smaller venues, you meet people and you get to know each other. I mean, it's great. I mean, I did love that Salt Lake City was a much smaller town than I'd ever lived in, so. That was kind of fun about it. And I did find the Mormon community. I mean, everybody was really nice. So I didn't really have any negative experiences socially with the Mormon community. Yeah.
But I do have to, I mean, I can imagine how a place like Salt Lake City wouldn't be a big goth subculture, but whatever goth subculture would exist in a place like that would be like pronounced and maybe close-knit.
Yes, very close-knit. Very, very close-knit. Which was kind of nice. You know, I liked it. Yeah.
So, okay. So here's part two.
Okay.
Rouge is set in La Jolla.
Yes.
You've kind of touched on this a little bit, but we should talk about it some more. La Jolla, aesthetically, is like paradise. It's beautiful.
Yes, it is.
Like hills, you know, it's like, for people who have not been, it's basically these dramatic hills that essentially drop off into the Pacific Ocean. Houses are up on the hills. It is stunningly beautiful. And yet, in the world of Rouge, it is filled with, you know, Tom Cruise.
Right.
With menace. I think you talked earlier about the ocean and how it is this beautiful, you know, magnificent natural wonder and a kind of mirror in its own right. You know, it reflects all this light, but yet what's down there? You know, there is something really grim and scary about the ocean that I think a lot of us feel. So just talk a little bit about landing on La Jolla as the setting for Rouge. And as you said earlier, I believe you wrote this book in La Jolla. You spend time in La Jolla regularly?
Mm-hmm. I have written there. I wrote a lot of All's Well there. I proofread Bunny there. So just in terms of creativity, it's been good to me. Yeah.
How did you wind up in La Jolla? Like, how did you settle on La Jolla?
Well, I just had a really good first experience there. I lucked out with an Airbnb. It was right by the water. And so, you know, when I had that experience and I was just like, wow, this is really, really great for writing. I want to come back. And then I just booked a longer time and I just kind of, you know, did it off Airbnb and just got to know the person who rents it to me. And then, you know, I actually started getting the idea for Rouge as I was finishing All's Well by virtue of being there and going for walks along the water. And then I knew I wanted to come back and, you know, write that book, whatever it was. It was like starting to take form. And then I did, and it was one of the greatest creative experiences of my life to write Rouge in La Jolla, where it is set. You know, it was amazing. The ocean was right there. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. There is something very existential about the ocean, just fundamentally looking at the ocean, you know? And I love the fact that it is a mirror. And I love that when the sun is setting, you know, everything starts to look red. The Gothic is just inherent in existing on the edge of the abyss, which you do when you are in La Jolla. It's a beautiful abyss, but it's an abyss, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've spent some time down there, spent some time in Orange County. Like, so beautiful.
So beautiful.
This coastal part of California and Southern California, dramatic cliffs into the ocean, the whole thing. It's just stunning. I feel like when darkness exists in a place like that, that is paradisical.
Yes.
It's extra dark.
It's extra dark. I mean, that's why it's, you know, some of the creepiest, you know, scenes in horror take place during the day, because it's just unfathomable, right? And so I love the idea of that contrast, you know, the bright sunshine, this kind of really innocent place that's in such denial about death. You know, the whole aesthetic is to deny death, to have, you know, this really incredibly terrifying Gothic spa just tucked away, you know.
But if you haven't, I can totally imagine it.
Yeah,
I can totally imagine it. And I feel like too, socioeconomics are a big part of it. Like, La Jolla is very, very wealthy.
Yes.
And like some people who live there just have
endless
money.
Yeah.
And yet, that we all know, at least theoretically, that endless money does not insulate you from unhappiness, and in fact it can exacerbate it and make it even worse. I mean, it's not a panacea. And so it's like endlessly wealthy people living in this place that is aesthetically perfect, with all the money in the world to indulge their fantasies of not aging and to try to deny the reality of death and to look great at 80, you know, like whatever it is. And there's a real, like that's when I feel like you really know misery. I think my experiences there, sometimes directly, but more often as kind of an undercurrent, is to feel like, wow, there's an intense undercurrent of human unhappiness here.
Yeah.
Because every need is sort of satisfied.
Right.
Like you have everything you could possibly want.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
No, because it's like a soul hunger, so it will never go away. Put a bomb on it.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, here's a natural question. Having written this book and explored these themes so deeply, how do you satiate or satisfy the soul hunger that you just talked about? Like, what's the answer? Like, what is it that we want, that we really want? What would make us, like, here's the best definition of happiness that I've ever heard. I stole it and I just always use it whenever I need it.
Okay.
True happiness is to be free from wanting.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Right? I mean, it's like, okay, yeah, if I didn't want anything, that I think I would be. But like, how do you get there? Because even if, like we've seen, even if like people who are so rich, not enough, still want more. You know, like, have you learned anything about yourself in this respect to maybe be a little bit less soul hungry?
Well, I mean, the happiest that I am, that I can be, like the moments of great, great happiness that I've known have been, I'm not even kidding, like alone in the dark with a story when it's leading me somewhere new and exciting and it really feels alive and I'm really inside of it. I mean, that feels otherworldly, and it does feed my soul. But at the same time, in order to have that experience, this is the paradox, I guess, I'm giving over my soul. I'm putting it in the story. So there's less of me on the other side of it. So it's weird. I'm being fed, but I'm also giving it up.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And you're also, there's also like a forgetting of self.
Yes.
It's an act of generosity. You're in service to the story. When you say you're in the dark with a story, like, you know, as a like bona fide goth,
yeah.
Does this mean you're actually in the dark? Like, do you shut off all the lights and draw the curtains when you write? Like, are you in a pitch black room with just the glow of your screen? Or
I don't like to write with like lots of light on. It just makes me just too aware of the room and all of that. I mean, I don't like make it pitch black or anything, but you know, I'll just write in a room that maybe has like natural light coming through the curtains or something, but maybe no other lights turned on, just so that I can focus on just the world, right, and forget where I am a little bit. It's more just to turn off that critical part of the brain, you know, that is like, it has to be perfect. Work on those sentences. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
Well, I think what you're saying is something I've heard people say. So something I've heard myself say through the years is the best part of writing is the doing it.
Yes.
Like, the publishing is great. I think it's easy to kind of trick yourself into thinking like, once this thing's published and it's in the bookstore, you know, it's going to be, that's what I'm after. But it's really not what you're after. What you're after are the kinds of moments that you just described, where you're alone with the work. It's just you and the story, and it's going well.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
That's peak happiness.
It's peak happiness. And it is both soul nourishing and soul sacrificing at the same time.
So you have to feed yourself and destroy yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
For those of you listening at home, feed yourself and destroy yourself.
That's right.
That is the Mona Awad formula for how to be happy, and moisturize every
day. Very important. Yes.
Very important. It is important, I think, to take care of your skin. I always ask people when I'm talking to them at the end of the conversation if they are working on something else. I got to say, you've been very productive.
Yes.
You're making lots of books. You are industrious.
Yes, yes, it's true. I am working on a prequel to Bunny right now, which has been very fun. Yes. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun to work on. So, yeah, it takes place the first year of the MFA.
So it's still in the MFA.
Yes, yes. It's when the bunnies are learning that they have this power, and it's about their first creation.
That could be useful to the adaptation. You're like fleshing out the world a bit more.
Yeah. No, absolutely. For sure.
Is that part of the motivation? Like, was to like, well, this has been really resonant. Maybe I can explore this further, or just, this is just what grabbed you.
No, it's really just what grabbed me. I mean, it was again that thing of just, I missed it so much, and I kept going back to it in my head creatively. And then this story, it just started to come to me. So I just felt like, and it did while I was working on Rouge. So I knew that when I finished Rouge, I would have to give it a try at least and see. And then when I did, I got really excited, and I was like, oh yeah, okay. I'm going to try this for real and see what happens.
It's a franchise. This is your franchise.
Yes.
Do you think it's possible that you might write even more books in this world with these characters? Like, is this something you could see yourself really exploring across multiple titles?
I can see one more after this one. Beyond that, I don't think so. But this one is very, like, it's very solidified in my head, as it obviously connected to Bunny very deeply, but its own work separate from Bunny too. So, yeah.
All right. So last question then.
Yeah.
Is there a commonality in terms of how your books originate for you? Like, where do you, like, what does it, how do the germs of these things come to you? Like, and when do you start to realize that you've got something?
Yeah. Usually it will start with a moment of really intense powerlessness. So if I think about it another way and I don't use the word powerless, I might say a moment of obsession or enchantment with something in the world, you know, an interaction or, you know, something in media maybe. And that's what it was for Rouge. But usually it is. Yeah, it's a feeling of real visceral powerlessness in the face of something that I can't fully grasp or give language to. And it usually does render me speechless, you know, in some way. Because when I say powerless, I usually do also mean speechless. I have no words. So then telling the story is my way of trying to figure that moment out, you know. And it usually leads me to a place that feels very exciting in terms of a story.
So for the prequel to Bunny, was it the same feeling that you had that caused you to write Bunny, or was it like a new feeling of powerlessness that gave you the idea for the prequel?
Yeah, it was new. It was a new feeling of powerlessness. Imagining what the creation might feel as opposed to the creator. How the creation might experience being created and thrown into a world. So yeah, it's different because Bunny was about the anxiety of the creator. Right. This prequel explores both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've got my interest. And I congratulate you on Rouge and all the success that you've had.
Thank you.
You know, early on in your career, you're really, I feel like you're building something. And I admire how hardworking you clearly are to have created all these books in pretty rapid succession. So kudos to you. Thank you for the time, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Brad.
All right, folks, there we go. That was my conversation with Mona Awad. Her new novel is called Rouge. It is available now from Mary Sue Rucci Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. You can find Mona on the internet. Her website is monaawadauthor.com. She is also on Instagram. Once again, the new novel is called Rouge. Go get your copy immediately. Don't forget to subscribe to this show wherever you listen. You can also subscribe on YouTube, follow the show on social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. You can sign up for my free newsletter at otherppl.com or bradlisty.com. Join the Other People Patreon community over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you have a minute and you want to do me a quick favor, please give this show a rating wherever you listen. If there is an option to write a review, write a little review. It helps the show find new listeners. It helps it in the rankings. It helps it in the algorithm. If you want to get another people t-shirt, you can do that at the show's official website, otherppl.com. Just scroll down, look for the t-shirt. You can't miss it. And finally, a quick plug for my latest novel. It is almost a year and a half old, I think. It's called Be Brief and Tell Them Everything. It is available in trade paperback, ebook, and audiobook editions. I narrate the audiobook, so if you want to read my book, or if you want me to read it to you, that is an option. Once again, it is called Be Brief and Tell Them Everything. Okay, so coming up on Wednesday, my guest will be Vahini Vara. Her debut novel, The Immortal King Rao, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and she now has a hotly anticipated new story collection coming out. It is called This Is Salvaged, and I'm very excited about this one, so stay tuned.